Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Well, the setting is Cambridge, Massachusetts, Harvard University to be precise. The crime, murder. The protagonist, one very smart reporter named Alexandra James, who gets pulled into a web of international intrigue that takes her from Cambridge to London to Pakistan.
These are the elements of a new spy thriller from Mary Louise Kelly, who spent 20 years as a producer, reporter, and host for NPR and the BBC. Most recently, she was NPR's national intelligence correspondent. Mary Louise Kelly's new novel is called Anonymous Sources, and she'll be appearing tonight at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, and she joins us right now in our studios. And Mary Louise, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a real thrill. And this book, I got to say, is a lot of fun. So let's set the hook right away and start with a brief reading, if you don't mind. I'm going to set up this much. Thomas Carlyle, a popular young man who graduated from Harvard, is up in the bell tower of Elliott House at Harvard. And then something awful happens.
And he thinks he's all alone.
He thinks he's all alone.
Up in that tower, but here we go. This is, we're reading from page 5 of Anonymous Sources. Tom took another sip and watched the boats gliding along the Charles. Lord knew how many hours he himself had logged on this river. By the time he made varsity crew, the boathouse had felt more central to his college experience than any library, and the blisters across his hands had hardened like tiny stones. A sculler flitted past, then an 8-man crew. Was that Boston University? But why would they be practicing so late, and on summer break at that? He squinted and craned forward, trying to make out what colors were painted on the oars. It was at that moment that hands reached from the shadows behind him. The blow landed at the bottom of his skull, a crack of wood against bone. There was a moment of perfect silence before Tom swung his strong arms, clawing behind him, but the foot was already on his back. One kick, but hard enough to launch him off the sill and onto the roof 10 feet down. He crashed into the pointed tip of a dormer window and rolled, grabbing for a gutter, a ledge, anything. There was nothing, and he fell, wide-eyed, into the gathering twilight below.
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
It's a real page-turner. Obviously, the story unwraps the mystery of who killed Thomas Carlyle and why. And your heroine is a smart, pushy reporter from the fictional newspaper, The New England Chronicle, named Alexandra James. So tell us a little bit about her. I like this character a lot.
Well, Alexandra James, she got her name from my sons, Alexander and James, because when I was setting my alarm to try to write this at 4 a.m. before getting up and going to my correspondent job at NPR, and I was cursing the idea that I'd ever started this, I wanted to be reminded why I was doing it. She is, as you said, she reports for a fictional newspaper named the New England Chronicle, which may or may not bear a passing resemblance to the Boston Globe. And she is feisty. She has bright red hair. She has great legs. She has a talent for getting into mischief.
And she knows about those great legs and uses them
she
to a
uses
certain
them.
Advantage.
She
right.
works them, absolutely. She is assigned to cover this death of Tom Carlyle, which initially looks like a local crime, awful, but a local murder. And then she quickly realizes she has stumbled onto something much bigger and
yes.
starts chasing the trail.
Mary Louise, you've covered national intelligence and a certain amount of international intrigue. Is Alex James a character that you've imagined, that you've wanted to be in some way? Or what does she have in common with you, I guess, is the
well,
better question.
Well, let's see. She has better legs than I do. We'll start there. This is radio, so y'all will have to take my word for that. She, I wanted to make her realistic. So in a lot of cases, she is asking the same questions that I would have asked if I were presented with the same information and chasing a similar story. She is very much learning to work her sources. She's on the education beat. She's in Boston. So,
right.
She's covering higher ed in all of the universities here. And I did that in part because it was such an adventure for me to learn how to cover national security and intelligence that it was kind of fun to watch a fictional character go through that. It also it allows her to ask questions that a normal person would ask that, a hackneyed old reporter who'd covered the spy beat for 50 years wouldn't have to ask what an acronym means or who to turn to next. But I let her have a little bit of fun. I mean, it's fiction. It's a thriller.
Sure.
I tried to stick to the facts, but, for example, she shoots one of her sources, and I have never had occasion yet to shoot any of my sources on
you're
the
You're still young. You've still got a big
There's
career
time.
In front of you. There's
Who
time.
Knows?
But this idea that, like you, she sort of has to learn a beat as she goes along, and I want to ask you a little bit about covering the national intelligence beat. I'm trying to figure out sort of where the blueprint is for covering the CIA.
Oh, I wish I knew. I mean, when I started the CIA beat, it's very different from covering the Pentagon or the White House or the State Department, other big, important Washington beats, but where you can get press credentials and go wander around the building and call people and they will speak to you on the record and they hold daily press briefings at the State Department. And, you know, obviously a good reporter is not just going to cover that, but it's at least a starting point. Whereas when you start covering the CIA, they almost never hold a press conference. They almost never issue a press release. If you call the press office, I didn't even have that phone number the day I started.
They even
you know,
keep
there's
that
no
secret.
Directory. There's nothing.
Yeah.
When they travel, they don't tell you. They certainly don't invite you to go on the plane the way that reporters covering the White House or the State Department do. So it is really feeling around in the dark when you start. And I started, you know, more than other beats, you have to rely on people who maybe are recently retired and a little bit more at liberty to speak and who you hope maybe will cycle back in and be useful to you at some point down the road. But you, it's like anything else. You start chasing a crumb and you don't know where it's going to take you.
Eventually, you get to the loaf,
you hope.
So one of the themes in this book, and this also gets back to what you did, the book, of course, Anonymous Sources, is this sometimes perilous relationship between reporters and their sources. So what's the source of this peril? What's the concern here? What's the issue?
Well, so in the book, Alex James is chasing what turns out to be a huge national security story, and the full scale of it is not clear to even her till the very end, but she is working sources, learning how you work your sources, learning how to deal with, again, on the intelligence beat, you almost never get somebody to speak to you on the record. Mm-hmm. And it's that much harder when you're doing it for broadcast. Mm-hmm. You've just convinced somebody to try to speak to you, and then you whip out a microphone and try to record it. And, you know,
and they say, oh,
that's
no,
another whole conversation.
You can't record me. Right. Yeah.
So when I did the intelligence beat, you know, the default that people go to is they want to be off the record. And you start working with that and you work your way up. And it's learning when somebody wants to speak to you as an anonymous source, how, when to grant that, how you gauge the information they're giving you. I mean, I had one question about when I was doing a book talk in Washington and a former head of the CIA, Bill Webster, showed up. And he said in his question, he said, you know, I always wondered with your reporters whether anonymous sources you used them so that you could kind of get away with something that maybe you weren't quite so confident and kind of float things. And I, it's funny, I think it's actually the reverse. You know,
the anonymous sources might well be using you.
Well, they might well be using you. But I, as a reporter, if I agree to quote somebody as a senior intelligence official but not share with the listener their name, I feel like I'm vouching for them myself. I'm saying I have vetted this person. I think they're in a position to know what they're talking about. Mm. I think I trust them, and you know, you're going to have to trust me on this. I can't tell you their name, but this is why you should listen to what they have to say.
Mary Louise, I'd love to ask you a question or two about your decision to leave NPR and become a full-time writer, and tell us the story about the day you hit the wall. You wrote about this very eloquently last March on the Daily Beast, and your story begins with you in a helmet and flak jacket, in a helicopter in Iraq, following the Secretary of Defense, right?
Yeah, a typical day at work.
A typical
Pentagon
day at work.
Right.
Okay. So set the scene and tell us what happened.
So, right, when I had taken on the Pentagon beat, and in addition to the intelligence beat, and that part of that involves traveling when the Defense Secretary travels. So the Defense Secretary tends to go to war zones. So we had landed in Iraq. The streets are not safe enough to allow a cabinet secretary to drive through them, so usually you get around via helicopter or plane. So yeah, we were strapping in one day. We had been overseas already through Israel and Jordan and a few other stops on this trip, and we're about to take off in this Black Hawk, and my cell phone vibrated, and it took a minute for me to push under my flak jacket and answer it, and the voice that came down the line, it took me a minute to figure out who it was, and it was the nurse at my child's school back home in Washington, D.C., saying, your youngest son is sick. Can you come get him? And I'm starting to explain, actually, no. You know,
not going to happen today.
Not going to happen. And she cut in and said, no, I don't mean to bring him home. I mean, he is really sick. He's barely breathing. We need to get him to a doctor now, or maybe to the hospital now. And, you know, any parent who gets these phone calls, you feel your heart skip a beat. And I was trying to figure out how to answer her when we lost the line, you know, just completely went out of cell phone range. And it was a few hours before I could get back in touch. And I did hit the wall, you know, that the Blackhawk took off and we were in the air. And I just remember looking down over the traffic of Baghdad and thinking, this ain't working. I have a 4-year-old. I have a 6-year-old. It is time for Plan B, career Plan B.
And 7 months later or so, you resigned from NPR.
I did.
You wrote in that piece, which was a bit of a response, or at least it was timed such that it seemed like a response to Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO of Facebook, who wrote a book urging women to lean in. And you wrote, with sincere and enormous respect for the accomplishments of superwomen like Sheryl Sandberg, I wonder if there isn't room for a more expansive definition of female professional success.
Yeah, I guess professional success broadly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel, and I meant it, I feel enormous and sincere respect for her. She's making the choice that is right for her and her family. I hit a place where the choice of covering the Pentagon beat and all of the travel and unpredictable hours that involved was not the right choice for me and my family. But it's funny, that article that ran in the Daily Beast, they headlined it Leaning Out.
Right.
When the Sheryl Sandberg approach does not work. And I remember when I first saw that and I thought, really? I don't feel like I'm leaning out. I still, you know, contribute to NPR. I've written a book. I'm on a book tour. I'm writing a second book. I feel like I'm busy all the time. And I could never have done those things without the background that I had at NPR. And you try to keep doors open. And who knows? It may be that in a few years that feels like the right place to be again.
You got a lot of response from readers to that post.
I did.
I noticed a couple of them. A lot of them applauded your decision. One reader said, where the heck, you didn't use the word heck, where the heck was your husband?
Yeah, I got that a lot. And I will say on his behalf, I think the school nurse called him next. And he dealt with it and got to the doctor and all was fine. That doesn't stop your heart from skipping a beat when you get those type phone calls.
Sure.
But yeah, he was there.
And you wrote in the piece that your typical day now involves dropping the kids off at school, writing for a few hours, picking the kids up, supervising homework, tucking them into bed, write for another hour or so, maybe even do some laundry. The jet-setting correspondent, it ain't.
Yeah.
But still, any regrets about the move away?
I miss the newsroom every day. Mm. I think if it's in your blood, it stays in
sure.
your blood. And I do miss it. And every time there's a huge story on my old beat, I am climbing the walls. This whole NSA leaker Edward Snowden scandal, as a reporter, it is such a fascinating story, and I would love to be on it. I will also say, though, I can tell you the exact moment that story broke. It was a Wednesday night. Because my son's graduation from school was the next day, and I remember thinking, you know, if I were to ever go back to my old beat, I would be getting the call to come into the newsroom right now, and I certainly would not be making it to school graduation tomorrow, and I'd be missing my brother's wedding this coming weekend, and, you know, these are the trade-offs.
Well, it sounds like you've made a great one. So what's next? You're working on another book.
I'm working on another book. I'm working on a sequel to Anonymous Sources, and then working on a separate second book, which is also a thriller, but has different characters. And
I'm glad to hear that Alex James is going to this attractive, sassy reporter is going to sort of stick with us.
Well, she was fun to write and she got more fun as the book went along. You get to know your characters and you start, you know, I would wonder as I just went about my daily errands, kind of have her in my head with me as we walked around and you get to know her and they become real. So I think half the work's done for writing a sequel. I got her.
Well, Mary Louise Kelly, such a pleasure. We've known each other for a long time. We didn't even mention that we used to work together a million years ago.
We did.
Great to have you in. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
That's Mary Louise Kelly. She's the former national security correspondent for NPR. Her new novel is called Anonymous Sources. She'll be talking about it tonight at 7 at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge. And you can read an excerpt from the book at radioboston.org.
Well, stick with us, because up next, would you pay a carbon tax in Massachusetts? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.